Bitcoiners, what is up? I'm sitting across from Ansel, and we just concluded an awesome conversation with the one, the only, Jeff Snyder. Jeff is from Alhambra Partners, and he is a leading thinker on how the economy actually works today. He has been putting out some of the most thought-provoking and just crystal-clear analysis of the macroeconomy, and it's the second time we brought him onto the show, and it's always a pleasure. Ansel, what's the breakdown of this episode?
Oh, it was really good. It's, you know, we do shorter form podcasts, so we just can introduce these topics and kind of tease out some of the main points. I recommend people, if they get sparked their interest on this stuff from Jeff, I definitely recommend going and checking out his other stuff, because there's so many little minute tangents that you can go on that we didn't get to cover at all. But I thought it was a really great episode. We did dive a lot into CBDCs and Bitcoin, and we talked, got his opinion on the whole space. So I think it was really good. I think the people will love it.
Yep. And y'all, Jeff is in Florida. After this, I'm going to DM him to try to make sure that he's at Bitcoin 2021 in Miami. But if you're not going to Miami, are you even a Bitcoiner at this point? Like, all of the energy in the Bitcoin sphere is being sucked into the city of Miami. It is really like the torch-bearing city of freedom. Mayor Suarez is going to be welcoming the Bitcoiners into the city on the first day of the conference. And this event is going to be absolutely banging. We are releasing the lineup later today. And go to b.tc /conference and go check out the entire agenda. It is absolutely stacked. I am super, super hyped for the keynote fireside chat between Michael Saylor and Max Keiser. If you can't think of, I think that they're going to take bullish to another level, to be honest. So I'm really hyped for that one. But so much more amazing content going out there. Check us out at the Bitcoin Conf on Twitter and go to b.tc/conference to learn more. Get your tickets today. They're already pretty expensive. We're going to increase the price a little bit more leading into the last 2 weeks before the event. And it is going to be 10,000 plus Bitcoiners in Miami. So really, truly epic crowd. And once again, freedom is something that Bitcoiners are on the forefront of. And I think this event is just an example of that. Bitcoiners are not afraid. Bitcoiners are going to continue to push the forefront of freedom. And if you want your best price on that Bitcoin 2021 ticket, you need to buy with Bitcoin. And you can use our partners over at MoonPay in order to swipe your credit card, use Apple Pay, use Google Pay, use Samsung Pay, use your debit card. It doesn't matter. Use your fiat payment rails, but pay us in Bitcoin. We want to get paid in Bitcoin. So we are offering a $400 discount off of GA tickets if you pay in Bitcoin. And once again, you can get the best of both worlds if you use MoonPay. MoonPay, there's a widget on the ticket website, super easy. Again, like I said, use your favorite payment option that is in the fiat landscape. Pay us in Bitcoin, get your discount. It is a win-win. MoonPay is an awesome infrastructure company that builds in payment solutions directly into non-custodial wallets. So guess what? You could be on your favorite phone wallet and you can buy sats with Apple Pay because your wallet is already integrated with MoonPay. And from there, they're going to send you sats directly to your non-custodial wallet. Forget about Coinbase, forget about Cash App, forget about all of these other solutions where you have to even deal with a custodian. Instead, you can get mom on a non-custodial wallet. She can use Apple Pay. She doesn't have to deal with any sort of KYC. And then boom, she gets sats straight to her wallet on her phone. Can't think of a better way to onboard newbies. MoonPay is doing awesome work and their infrastructure is not just in wallets, but it is everywhere. So check them out over at b.tc and go check them out over at MoonPay's website. All right, that is enough from me. Go to Bitcoin 2021 and listen to this podcast with Jeff Snyder.
All right, friends, it is my honor to welcome back to the show Jeff Snyder. He is head of global research at Alhambra Partners. He writes an incredible blog there that I consume pretty much every day. He also has a very thought-provoking podcast with Emil Kalinowski called Making Sense, Eurodollar University. So welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me, Ansel.
So today we might jump around quite a bit here in the, for lack of a better term, I guess, macro landscape. We'll jump around. FedWatch is for the Bitcoin ecosystem, just to keep people up to date on what's going on monetarily out there, because obviously Bitcoin is, we believe, a money technology, and there's plenty of inflationist content where it's all about money printing and the death of the dollar is nigh and all of that stuff. I personally think it's much more complicated than that. So last time you were on was August of last year, so about 9 months. There's a few things that have happened since then, some big events. I think February had a big event. So can you get us up to date on what you were seeing out there on the macro landscape?
Well, I think the biggest thing that's happened is commodity prices. And of course, last week's CPI, which, as everybody has said, this puts us in the 1970s territory, right? I mean, we can't possibly now, who could argue against the highest month over month increase in the core CPI rates in 1982? If that doesn't scream great inflation, then I don't know what does, right? I mean, so apparently the inflationist dollar crash, all that stuff is happening, or is it? I think that's really kind of the question is, you know, the Federal Reserve has said, and a lot of mainstream economists agree, that this inflation isn't really inflation. It's nothing more than transitory impacts. And for once, I find myself agreeing with the Federal Reserve and economists, which puts me in an incredibly uncomfortable position because I never want to be agreeing with the Federal Reserve and economists because they usually get these things wrong, especially where it comes to inflation. So immediately I'm thinking, oh, wait, what am I doing wrong here? But the truth of the matter is the inflation case continues to be an outlier. And I know it's hard to make that claim when everything that you see and hear in the mainstream media is inflation, 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 inflation. It's 1970s. But yeah, you look at the bond market says, what the hell is everybody talking about? There's nothing out there. And I think the key thing that most people miss where it comes to inflation in the bonds is that the bond market is a global marketplace. It's not just looking at, you know, even U.S. Treasury yields are not just looking at the United States situation or the U.S. CPI. It's looking at the entire global system and saying, okay, yeah, there might be some hot spots here and there, but have you seen what it's like out there in the rest of the world? It's not good at all. It's not much recovery, and certainly not as much recovery as many people were hoping and expecting since last year. And in fact, that contributes this disinflationary undercurrent to bond yields because we're looking beyond strictly the U.S. system and the U.S. CPI to all these other global factors that frankly are quite concerning still.
So talk to us a little bit about these global factors that people need to be kind of like looking into and considering.
Well, global macroeconomic factors is simply the economy as it is versus where it should be. And the economy as it is throughout much of the rest of the world is quite frankly atrocious. I mean, the recovery hasn't even been a recovery here in the US, but the US is probably the best off out of all the other, you know, we're back into the nomenclature of the cleanest dirty shirt, all the stuff that from 2015, 16 forward. Yeah, the US has performed relatively better than most of the rest of the world, but I mean, look at our neighbors to the south in Mexico. Their economy is devastated. Latin America, devastation. Even the Chinese recovery, which is again talked about as this arbiter of strength, when in fact the Chinese recovery has been unusually weak. And we have to stop and ask, well, what's really going on here? Because the US seems to be set on fire. At least the goods part of the economy in the US seems to be set on fire. Services is another story. But the rest of the world, you take a more global picture or a much, much more global survey of what's going on, and you start to get the impression, oh, okay, now I understand why this transitory inflation talk, where it's coming from. And where it's coming from is that the economy worldwide is not behaving the way it is in the U.S., at least in the goods economy in the U.S., where everybody is shopping on Amazon because they can't go out at night.
Yeah, that's interesting. I just read a piece about the Chinese credit impulse kind of going. If you follow the, you know, the different euro dollar crises that we've had over the last 10 years, the credit pulse out of China is what kind of dictates that. And it's kind of sliding back down. Do you see this going into some sort of double dip, or is there a cycle that we're repeating here?
Longer term cycle. Ansel, yeah, that's the question. Is the reflationary running out of steam? Are we seeing it roll over? And if we were seeing it roll over, which would go back to transitory inflation, which isn't inflation, but transitory price impacts, if we were seeing that kind of reflation rollover, we would see it in China first, because China is usually where these negative impacts manifest. I mean, they're the leading economic transition between the developed world, certainly in the rest of the world. So if the Chinese economy is not performing up to snuff, and it is actually kind of slowing down, which recent indications suggest that it is. That it never really got that much, that got that high to begin with in recovering from last year. And now it's kind of lingering around at the low level. That would have a lot of negative impacts going forward. And I don't know if we can say for sure right now that it's rolling over. What we can say is that it hasn't attained the reflationary altitude that we might have expected. And that raises the risks, certainly, of, you know, in the intermediate term, that it could start to stall out and roll over. And I think that's probably what's animating bond yields more than anything, is that we haven't really seen that real push of momentum in China that would continue the rest of the global recovery down the inflationary path. Instead, the Chinese have almost tried to force it to move forward. And ironically, it's Chinese consumers that have been that have had it the worst off in China, which is exactly where, you know, the Chinese authorities are expecting their internal dynamics to come from. They're expecting rebalancing, or what they call nowadays dual circulation, which is Chinese consumers to pick up the slack. And it's Chinese consumers who are lagging behind. And so you have to wonder, okay, last year didn't go as well in the second half as we were supposed to, or what we were thinking. Then this year it's the slowdown is continuing. Maybe we are getting in a position where the reflationary trend is starting to stall out and maybe even roll over.
So maybe we can take a step back real quick and just cover your vantage point is from the Eurodollar financial system. Can you flesh that out for us? Maybe what you see as the overarching forces in the monetary system?
Well, to begin with, the Eurodollar system is a bank-centered system, which means money creation is undertaken by bank balance sheets. And so if there's anything that constrains the banking system, bank balance sheets individually, then collectively in the aggregate, then that would act as a monetary brake on real economic growth. And that's really what we've seen, to put it very succinctly, that's what we've seen since August of 2007, where you've had balance sheet growth go reverse. Risk-taking has basically died out, and most banks have become risk-averse, which causes all sorts of constraints on balance sheet growth and balance sheet maintenance and things like that, which then becomes monetary tightness, which restricts economic growth, certainly through trade channels and global cooperation, those kinds of things as well. So in essence, you have bank balance sheets that are constrained, therefore they can't contribute the monetary resources that the global economy needs to grow free of that kind of impediment. And without any kind of change in the underlying conditions as far as the global banking system goes, the monetary system is gonna act as a restraining factor on the global economy.
Well, I guess my question is, so that was like a high level viewpoint about like how banking plays into it. And then I want to kind of zoom in like into maybe even consumer actions. You're talking about, you know, consumers in China aren't really bringing things back. I've really noticed, you know, for let's call it 18 months that consumers in Western countries, especially the US, are a lot more prone to, let's call it, just speculation on financial assets and wanting to dive into financial assets. And I would even say using traditional financial assets and equities as savings vehicles. I've seen this also in Canada, UK, you know, a lot of other English speaking countries I have access to. I'm kind of curious, do you have a perspective on that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's not a recent trend either. I mean, the retail discovery of crypto and digital assets is a recent phenomenon, but this trend has been in place for the last 40 years. And we saw it in my industry, you know, when my career, going back to the early days of the equity industry, that was the initial transition. I mean, the way people saved before the 1970s and 1980s was you put your money in the bank. And that was kind of what you did. And then along came the financial services industry in the 70s and 80s that broadened the appeal. And suddenly the stock market was the primary vehicle of savings. And in the 1990s, it led to this idea that you let your money work, do the work for you, and you really don't have to do anything special to retire a millionaire. That attitude took hold, and it has only gotten worse ever since then. And now what's happened is the average retail person has to chase all sorts of financial assets in order for that idea to come to fruition, or at least even to have any plausible means of retiring this millionaire. And so one bubble after another, it's really the same thing. It's how do we retire as millionaires without having to do any work? How do we let these markets run, do all that saving for us? And really, digital currencies and digital assets are just the latest new fad technology that has caught the attention of the retail investor to try to accomplish that goal. And what really makes it attractive to the retail investor is that there's underlying use to the stuff. What ends up happening typically, certainly in the dot-com era, it was perfectly evident, is everybody jumped on the stuff about 10, 15, 20 years too early. They just jumped on it because it was new and it sounded like it had some kind of use, but nobody really knew what that was. We didn't know which one was valuable, which companies were going to survive, but it didn't matter. And the same thing, I think, with digital currencies. You can see right away that there's use to them. There's a future for them. But we don't know which ones are going to be survivors, which ones are going to end up being used or what. And everybody just kind of piles into all of them, hoping to ride whichever one does win for the next, 5, 10, 15 years.
Well, stocks are just one of the classes, I guess, that gets lumped into this asset price inflation. You get, bonds and you get real estate and stocks. That's what the inflationists always point to say, look, that's where the inflation is. So do you have a thought? What is your counter when people say, yeah, that's where we see the inflation? Deflation is happening right now and CPI is garbage.
Well, that's usually what happens when inflationists lose the argument. They have to say, well, the CPI just doesn't reflect the underlying fundamentals, which are obviously tremendously inflationary. And if the CPI didn't get adjusted hedonically and all these other things, then it would reflect this accurate reality. And you're right that in addition to the CPI being wrong, then there's also the stock market. The stock market's going up and that's QE money printing. It goes right into the stock market. But then you ask them, well, okay, tell me how that works. Where does the bank reserves go that ends up in the New York Stock Exchange? And they can't connect those two dots because there's no way to connect them. If that was true, if money printing from the Fed was leading to stock price appreciation, we'd be able to see it on somebody's balance sheet somewhere, even if it was in a footnote, right? But you can't do that because since 1929, the stock market and the money supply have been detached. There's no relationship there. And so what's going on in the stock market is really what we just talked about, which is the frenzy of retail savings, not money. It's not money printing that bids up the share prices. It's the fact that whatever fad or fancy has directed the retail attention to that particular moment in time, whatever factors are driving, that kind of, salivating consumer, lack of consumer, actually, in a lot of ways, the stock market is nothing more than the reverse of the lack of money flowing through the real economy. And a lot of it has to do with the way the companies have behaved too. Especially in the post-2008 environment, companies don't want to invest in their own business, so they buy back their own shares. And that has fed into this self-reinforcing feedback loop where companies buy shares and then people see that those companies do well. We want to buy their shares too. And it's actually this lack of liquidity in the real economy that's benefiting those in the stock market. So it's not necessarily money creation that's leading to rising share prices. And that's really the distinction, because inflation, how it's defined conventionally, inflation is a monetary phenomenon, and there is no money going into the stock market. It's all through savings and actions of consumers and companies.
Well, I've also thought that the trustworthy borrowers are going to be these Fortune 500s, the Dow Jones companies. So in a malaise where banks don't want to lend, they will restrict their lending to more creditworthy people. And those just happen to be these big businesses or people that, are buying, expanding their margin debt to buy more stocks or to buy real estate or whatever. So it just seems to me that that could be a connection as well.
It's really, Ansel, it's about what you don't see. And that's what makes it more difficult, because everything you do see points toward the inflation direction. Oh, stock prices are way up. Now we got the CPI that's up. The Federal Reserve balance sheet has exploded to more than $7 trillion now. I mean, bank reserves are, $4 trillion, these massive numbers. That's the stuff we see and we think, well, that's inflationary. That's got to be good. But as you just pointed out, it's the stuff you don't see that's deflationary. That's what actually explains the world as it is right now. Because, mom and pop can't get a loan. And that's the real economy. Whereas, any Fortune 500 can float any number of bonds at any kind of interest rate it wants. And then what do they do with the money? They buy back shares. They don't invest in the real economy. So the people, the companies and businesses that don't really need the funds to do economic things are the only ones who can get the funds. Is the rest of the economy goes completely, utterly dry. But because it doesn't show up in a financial index, it's not in a published interest rate. It all happens in the shadows, the invisible hand of Adam Smith. we don't see it. And so we don't think, oh, there's deflationary forces out there, but we can't see them. And it's not published on a balance sheet somewhere. And in fact, if you go looking for it in any kind of strict monetary terms, you have to look at the footnotes of these, you know, hundreds of pages of footnotes in the bank balance sheet reportings, their quarterly or the annual filings that they report the SEC. So, you know, the deflationary stuff, we never see it, but yet we see the results of it. And the inflationary stuff that never happens, well, we see what's supposed to cause the inflation, but we can't reconcile how we get the Fed's balance sheet exploding, but then we don't actually have sustained inflation. It's because it happens in the shadows, and not just in the U.S. This is, again, as I said, this is a global thing, where any number of global factors where companies around the world have trouble getting credit, have trouble getting financing, but we can't see it. We can't literally observe all the stuff going on, even though we see the effects of it as this mysterious inflation puzzle as the Fed calls it.
Yeah, and that also reminds me, so a lot of inflationists, they'll say that inflation through the Cantillon effect drives wealth inequality. But deflation can drive wealth inequality too, because it narrows down those creditworthy people that can get the access to the money. What do you have thoughts on that one?
No, I think that's exactly, you know, deflation drives inequality even worse than inflation would, because it does. It narrows it down into the most creditworthy, most liquid obligors or issuers, whatever you want, whatever they are. They're the only ones who can do well. In fact, that's really what economic progress is. It's when a broad swath of the economy all advances, not at the same rate or at the same in the same way, but everybody wins. That's economic growth. And economic constraint is where only some people win, and most, or not, it's not even most, it's just a large minority don't. And if that minority becomes too big, the economic constraint is what they, you know, what they now call a K-shaped recovery, which is really an L-shaped recovery, which is nothing more than people who are struggling can only ever struggle. But people who are doing well and businesses that are doing well, they do super well. And it, you know, you're sitting here in the minority that's not doing well, can't get credit, can't get any revenue growth, things don't look good, and you're sitting back watching the stock market zoom upward, 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 and thinking, well, this system's got to be rigged. It's got to be something, because I can't make any heads or tail of it. Yet these people over here, anything they do is you know, terrific, and it really contributes to that, not just the real inequality in economic circumstances, but also perceived inequality that starts to get into political problems and political changes and things like that. So it's really, it's you know, deflation in many ways, especially this kind of deflation where it's hidden, people can't connect the dots because you don't see the stuff that's going on that's preventing economic growth. And you start blaming anything and everybody, and you have no answers for it. And what makes it all the worse is that our clueless officials and politicians are out there saying, what are you talking about? Everything's great. You know, the economy, you know, before COVID, the economy was booming, right? I mean, the unemployment rate was the lowest it had been in 50 years. And everybody thought, oh, the economy's booming. Why doesn't it feel like it? You know, the stock market's at record highs. You know, this must be booming. And that, you know, you look at other indications that say, oh, there's something really wrong here. And we just, you know, we can't explain what it is. And we can't really see the cause from effect, and it creates one big hell of a mess.
So, Jeff, what Bitcoiners would say is that, and a lot of Bitcoiners subscribe to, let's say, the inflationist theory, but I think what, if you zoom out, what a lot of Bitcoiners would say is that money printing or interest rate manipulation or whatever central bankers are doing, all that does is create chaos, which ultimately distorts pricing signals, which ultimately destroys supply chains, which inevitably creates deflation and an inability to be productive at all. And then you're talking about, again, this specific system has, you know, is structured in a way where it's a banking-led system that's led by credit. And then that in itself also kind of like isolates who can get access to funds and whatnot. I guess, what's your take on this idea of pricing signals being destroyed and therefore destroying supply chains?
Well, I think as you described it, the Bitcoin position, or maybe the major crypto position, has it right, but just doesn't get all the way to the cause. They see the chaos, they see the underlying problems and think, well, there's something wrong with the monetary system. I think they've got that something wrong. They identify the wrong cause, but you're right. They're identifying with the chaos, the lack of results, lack of growth, the lack of stability, which is what we're really talking about here. Economic growth is usually a function of stability. When we have a stable system, that's what allows economic growth to not just develop, but to be sustained over a long period of time. And that's where I think the crypto people and even some Bitcoin maximalists might be, you know, they're correct. They're identifying, look, something's not right here. We think it's the Fed doing all this money printing and manipulating interest rates when I think, and I'm pretty sure that the rest of the world says, you know, the interest rate fallacy, we have a monetary problem that's not, it's the opposite of money printing. And so the Bitcoin view is one step short of causation. What they're looking at is the Fed doing quantitative easing and thinking that's the problem, but quantitative easing is a response to the problem. And then inevitably those two things, they converge in this deflationary lack of growth outcome. So well, it's almost like we get together by accident, right?
Well, sure. There's a problem. And then quantitative easing as a response creates even more chaos, right? And destroys more pricing signals, removes liquidity from the market. What, you know, all these are their second.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. And it's right. And all and just in just raw language terms, it prevents us from identifying the real cause, which is itself a self-reinforcing agent of chaos, that same chaos, right? Because we think, oh, well, the Fed did quantitative easing. That'll probably fix things. And then the public goes to sleep for a couple of years and wakes up and said, wait a minute, it didn't fix anything. Must be it was all that money printing, right? And it doesn't matter. There's no inflation. Doesn't matter the dollar's higher rather than lower. We realize something's not right because here comes the Fed again doing more quantitative easing. It's really, it's the inability to get to that original, you know, the original base problem that adds to all of these negative effects. And I think that's exactly what's going on with the crypto space and has been from the very beginning. It's really being unable to identify that original step, but being correct about where all this is going and where all this is really, you know, leading us, which is the fact that there is something wrong in the monetary system and it's causing problems in the real economy, real big problems in the real economy, such that we better start thinking about solutions. And the funny thing is, you know, the crypto stuff, Bitcoin, Ethereum, all these other ones nowadays, there's historical precedents for these going back centuries. Whenever you see a historical period where money has been tight, you know, the great bullion famine of the 15th century, for example, 15th, 16th century, led to something called ghost money. And ghost money, if you read about what ghost money is, it sounds a hell of a lot like Bitcoin. It really does. So there's historical precedence between monetary insufficiency and the private response to it, which often is, you know, let's create quasi money to create some kind of elasticity because we're not getting it in the quote unquote official monetary system.
Okay. Very interesting. First and foremost, I would like to say as like Ansel and I are Bitcoiners, we resent equating Bitcoin and crypto together just because Bitcoin is all about 21 million hard cap. And then right. Crypto is infinite printing, truly. And Ethereum and everything on top of it is truly infinite printing. All coin side, there's no end in sight. You know, Bitcoin showed people how to print endlessly. So I do like to make that distinction. But I am kind of curious on what your take is on Bitcoin and crypto, just because last time we spoke, it seemed like a fringe topic that, you know, was in your purview, but maybe you hadn't spent too much time on it. It sounds like, you know, at least by calling out Bitcoin maximalists, that you have definitely done a little bit more research.
No, I've been talking about crypto and Bitcoin for many, 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 many years. It hasn't been a big part of what I do because it hasn't been, you know, one of the primary public topics, or it's not something a lot of people talk about. It's certainly the people talk about in what I do and in the business I'm in. Of course, that's all changed over the last, since October of last year, when Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies went, you know, parabolic in their price behavior. So it's become more of a, not something something new for me, but more of something new that I'm willing to talk about because I want to talk some sense into Bitcoin versus crypto and all these other things. And I didn't mean to offend anybody by lumping all of them into. I think from my experience, when you say Bitcoin or crypto, people have no idea which one's which. It's all one thing to them.
That's our battle, man. That's our battle. It's a false equivalence. Bitcoin is one thing, and everything else is everything else.
It's the same battle that I'm on with, you know, euro dollar versus M2 money printing and the Federal Reserve and everything else. It's trying to drill down into, you know, these differentiable characteristics that are actually meaningful. So yeah, I think there is, you know, Bitcoin to me versus all the other cryptos, it's an interesting case. And I think I understand why Bitcoin has been created with limited capacity, because look, it seeks to mimic the gold, the best parts, I think, of the gold standard, which was you have a zero liability asset, which is essentially it is what it is. It can't be changed. And that's really, you know, the idea, sort of the elegance behind the traditional gold standard was in how, you know, it wasn't in the hands of government. It was actually, you know, in a way it was called sovereign money for a reason, because if you owned it, nobody else did. And if you owned it and took it out of the banking system, you were performing a very powerful check upon both the banking system and the government, because you deprived it of money. And so that kind of thing that the drives, I think, Bitcoin, in the idea that we need to constrain the monetary system by exogenous means, I think is perfectly reasonable. In fact, not just reasonable, it's commendable. Whereas some of these other cryptos are just simply, well, how do we just recreate what we're already doing in a digital type of format, which is sort of, you know, playing to the populist crowd, or you know, sort of just, yeah, how do we update, you know, and put some new paint on the way we do things anyway. Certainly the central bank digital currencies are exactly that. They're realizing that they're way, way behind what the private markets have already been doing for a very long time, and thinking, well, we got to at least pretend we're doing something. So let's slap together these digital currencies and call them that, and hope that nobody knows this is the difference.
I call it skeuomorphic and putting lipstick on a pig, but I'll send it over to Ansel.
It's true. The central banks are sitting back thinking, we're doing our QE. We're doing all these other things. It's going to be great. You know, we're going to fix the world. And then 14 years later, you know, digital currencies have only proliferated because they've done such a poor job. Now they think, well, we better get into this.
Yeah, our position on the show here is that, you know, the Fed is the one that's stiff-arming the whole CBDC thing. They constantly are saying, you know, we're waiting and seeing, we're taking a very conservative approach to this. And the other central banks like the ECB, the PBOC, those are the central banks that are pushing forward. And when you look at the private sector of these stable coins, like Tether and other digital dollar stable coins, there's no reason there couldn't be a digital euro, but people just don't want the digital euro. The entire world wants a digital dollar. And so I think these these smaller central banks, the ECB and the PBOC and those compared to the Fed, they are worried that they will lose some sort of share, market share, in the future if they don't expand like the private sector is doing with the dollar. Do you have any take on that?
Well, I don't know. The Federal Reserve branch in Boston has partnered with MIT's Digital Currency Initiative to develop what they're calling I don't want to say model digital currency, but I think they might actually have used that term. And if you read the term sheet, it's just full of arrogance and full of mistakes and full of all sorts of problems. I mean, like they say, prepared ahead of time, I would have had the quotes ready for you. But some of the quotes are just, you know, they said, you know, the private sector innovation isn't possible until we do our work first. I'm thinking, what are you people talking about? You're 15 years behind, you know, 13 years behind, 12 years, whatever it is. You know, you're so far behind, and now you're saying that the private sector is waiting for you to come up with a digital currency in order for it to be usable. No, it's completely unbelievable. And what I really objected to most is they said the ideal cryptocurrency, the ideal digital currency, is one that becomes a central bank liability. It's just, I'm shaking my head at them. You know, talking about getting two of the most important points completely 180 degrees wrong, but that's exactly what you would expect a Federal Reserve Bank to say. They would say, oh, money is a central bank liability, and nobody does anything in the monetary realm until we say so. That's the arrogance of modern central banks. It's the arrogance which gave us quantitative easing one after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, 20 years of this, because nobody is there to challenge them. And that's really what it comes down to, is lack of accountability. And in my sense, that's what crypto is really all about. That's what Bitcoin brought to the table, was the idea that we're going to challenge central bankers, make them put up or shut up, because enough is enough here. And central bank, what they say is, well, we're independent, which has meant that we're independent, which means nobody can say what we do. Nobody can challenge us. We're our own judge of accountability. So when Jay Powell goes before Congress and says, I'm doing a terrific job, nobody can say otherwise. That's what central bank independence has been. And crypto has been, as I said, the historic version of the public system saying, you aren't doing a good job. You're doing a horrible job. And we have to invent new ways to do your job in order for this to work. The problem is, of course, it takes a long time for these things to develop. And of course, in the 21st century, nobody has the attention span or patience to wait for these things to develop before, you know, before they reach fruition. But that's really what it is. Crypto is saying, look, you guys are not doing a good job and we're going to do your job for you. And if you don't get it right, we're going to end up replacing you. And that's really, I think that's the value in crypto and digital space. And again, I'm lumping them all together, but the value in the technology is that I think as central banks only continue to fail over time, the digital currencies become even more desirable places to do business. That doesn't mean the current prices are reflecting that reality. I think we've gotten way ahead of ourselves in that regard.
Yeah, we could go on for days about CBDCs specifically, because we've talked about it a lot on the show. We might have to have you back in another couple months to do a real deep dive on that. The interest rate fallacy you brought up, and this was one of these aha moments for me, was when I found out about the interest rate fallacy. Can you go through some of the history of that and describe exactly what that is?
Well, we're all taught that low interest rates are stimulus, right? I mean, this sounds intuitive, right? The Federal Reserve lowers interest rates. It makes it cheaper for borrowing. Therefore, there's more borrowing. There's more credit in the economy. The economy goes up. Everything's great. And conversely, if the Federal Reserve wants to slow things down, it raises interest rates, which raises the cost of borrowing, which puts a brake on economic growth. That's what we're all taught from the very beginning, whether it's economics 101 or even earlier. And it's just not true. First of all, the Federal Reserve does not control lending rates. It controls only a short-term monetary equivalent rate. And second of all, historical experience, as Milton Friedman pointed out in the 1960s, runs precisely the opposite direction. And it does so for the reasons we already talked about, Ansel. It's that, you know, during periods of tight money, only the most creditworthy and liquid borrowers can borrow money. So the U.S. government, for example, in the 1930s, which nobody in their right mind would confuse the 1930s for monetary overabundance or inflation, right? What were interest rates doing in the 1930s? They were low and falling, not rising. They were not high and rising. And they were low and falling because bank lending had not only dried up, it completely collapsed. So nobody could get any loans, but if you could float a bond, you could float a bond at almost any price you wanted to. So published interest rates continued to fall because the system wanted the most liquid creditworthy borrowers, and then only the most liquid creditworthy borrowers. Conversely, you go to the 1970s, which we call the great inflation for a reason. And what were interest rates doing in the 1970s? Well, they were in double digits all across the board because real money in the real economy could be used for any number of nominal projects seeking or getting any kind of nominal returns you wanted. So you didn't want a safe liquid instrument. You wanted anything risky because everything was going up. The prices of everything were going up. So the published interest rates or the mainstream interest rates, whether it's treasuries or whatever else, those yields all rose because inflation, money was flowing all throughout the real economy. And so that's the interest rate fallacy. It has to do with borrowing and credit and things like that. But when you see interest rates low, persistently low and going lower, that's a sign, as Friedman said, that's a sign that money has been tight in the real economy. And in the real economy is really the qualifier here, because it's exactly that shadow, the hidden stuff that we just talked about before. It's what we can't see. And so the low interest rates is actually telling us what's going on in the parts of the system we can't get into. And if we see interest rates go low and stay low, that's the system telling us we're avoiding those parts of the real economy because money is too tight everywhere else. We're only buying the highest quality, most liquid assets like U.S. Treasuries or German bonds or JGBs, whatever it is around the world. The most liquid, creditworthy assets are the ones that are in highest demand. And so low interest rates, tight money, high interest rates, the opposite.
Yeah, so the way I think of it is in the past, it was, or we're told, I guess, is that low rates lead to growth. And then growth, you know, they have to raise rates to, put a cap on growth so it doesn't get overheated. But in reality, what it is that bad times or bad economy leads to low rates, right? So isn't it like 180 degrees opposite of what we're told? Is that correct?
Yeah, and even some of the more recent academic scholarship conducted in the central banks and across the university system, they're starting to realize that at least that correlation. Now, there's all sorts of stuff with quantitative easing that, you know, if you read the literature, it says quantitative easing doesn't work. I'm talking about the central bankers. Their own literature says the stuff doesn't work. It doesn't lead to inflation. Now, when they start to ask questions about why that is, it's exactly what we're saying, is that low interest rates do not necessarily equal stimulus, because there's something else going on here. We're missing something. We're missing a big part of the equation. We see interest rates go down and we theorize that the low interest rates stimulate borrowing, but we're seeing the opposite of that. We have less borrowing, less economic growth, and it becomes this kind of situation like Japan, where it doesn't seem, whatever the central bank or central government comes up with, they can't seem to get out of it. It's almost like a trap. And that's really what it is, because by and large, they're missing the most important parts of the situation. It's not just low rates and, you know, okay, that has a direct economic effect. It's the banking system, the bank-centered monetary system that's a global system that causes this big breakdown.
I noticed on your most recent episode of Making Sense, you had on there a geopolitical analyst, and you guys were talking about all sorts of stuff, emerging markets, where can we look in supply chains? You know, what is this going forward? What's the kind of outlook for globalization versus deglobalization? I guess I wanted to tie that into the CBDC conversation and the other central banks. Do you see, obviously these central banks are all facing kind of their own, well, maybe it's not super unique in each different location, but how would you compare the central banks to getting to their goals, whatever they have out there? Am I making sense on this question?
No, yeah, I think what you're saying is that, look, central banks realize deep down they're not doing a good job. And then they realize that, okay, we're not doing a good job. We better do something somewhat different, not just the next QE in line, because then we'll just end up being Japan. And unfortunately, the rest of the world doesn't have the luxury of being a homogenized society where Japan can keep doing the same thing for 30 some odd years and not blow up. It's not going to work around the rest of the world. And the analyst we had on, Allison Federker from Geopolitical Futures, I mean, she's a really good, sharp, especially Latin American analyst. And as we saw this weekend in Chile of all places, which had been an island of stability amidst the usual churn and burn of Latin America, the Chileans had voted overwhelmingly for a leftist government or a leftist, let's call it, it's a Congress to rewrite their constitution. And it's going to be rewritten by a bunch of hardcore Marxists. And that's an understandable, if not condonable, reaction to the situation, which is, look, for the last 14 years, we have had reversing globalization or deglobalization, which has caused an enormous amount of problems, especially in emerging markets like Latin America. And so if you're in Chile, you're a Chilean central bank, you can't do anything about it. I mean, it's a dollar problem. It's a geopolitical problem. It's a global economic problem. You're just kind of trying to patch together whatever localized solutions or localized band-aid you can apply to the situation. And it really, you're only making it worse because you're doing what you're supposed to do according to the central bank handbook. And your population is just getting angrier and angrier because nothing seems to work. And eventually they reach a breaking point where they say, we'll just start from scratch. We'll just rewrite the whole damn system, which is essentially what's happening in Chile, which is really a warning sign because Chile, unlike its neighbor Argentina, Chile has been relatively stable since the Pinochet government was overthrown many, many years ago. And the fact that they're now going into the political extreme should, you know, alarm bells should be ringing all over the place. And I think they are in a lot of places. And you're right. A lot of other central bankers are looking at not just Chile, but all these other places where political and social unrest is becoming more and more of a significant problem, and thinking we got to do something to stay ahead of the torches and pitchforks. And part of that has been this ridiculous idea that central banks need to get involved in climate change, for example. I mean, talk about changing, completely reading their own mission. Now their central bankers are going to be involved in managing the climate. They can't manage money, let alone the economy. So now they're going to reward green investments and things like this. What they're really doing is what you just said, which is how do we survive here in an environment where more and more people are starting to realize we're really not doing our mission very well, And really, we're kind of useless. We better find something that we're useful for, or we're out of a job. And it goes into a lot of what's going on in central banks around the world. The Federal Reserve has been the least resistant to this trend, or the most resistant to the trend, because they think, well, dollar supremacy, the U.S. is the cleanest, dirty shirt. We have less to answer for than everybody else around the world. When in fact, when you look at it from the interest rate fallacy perspective or the global Eurodollar system perspective, it's the Fed that's the biggest problem out of all of them. So, you know, like everything else, it's upside down. And it's really hard to connect all these dots because of it. But yes, central banks have realized we got to do something here. You know, the Bank of Japan's been on quantitative easing for 20 years, and they're still doing it. We got to do something different.
Jeff, you know, what you're kind of getting around to is like central planning is the issue, right? This, like, we are dealing with extremely complicated systems that we just need to let, you know, kind of do their own thing. And every time these central planners try to manipulate, fix, decree top down, they end up making things a lot worse. It seems like in the case of Chile and most, you know, populist movements, like they're not actually, you know, most people aren't actually addressing that the issue is top down control. Can you like maybe talk about like the top down nature of how things are run today and why that is actually the issue?
Well, first of all, it comes from the Neo-Keynesians. Neo-Keynesians are a specific brand of Keynesianism that came out of the 1980s and 1990s. And first of all, they are very top-down. And second of all, they are very distrustful of markets. They don't believe in markets being rational ways to essentially create information, allow information to flow through the economy, and therefore the economy to most efficiently put itself together into a sustainable fashion. So, you know, the economists that are running central banks are all Neo-Keynesians to begin with. But then you have what's really, again, a human nature problem, which is after a prolonged period of lack of economic growth with no answers, people aren't interested in economic growth anymore. They're more interested in redistribution, which is exactly what we're seeing in Chile. It's what we're seeing in the United States. I mean, the federal government is going to start paying children in about 2 months from now. So we're seeing the redistribution effects when people say, look, this economy isn't working. I need to get mine, and the government better give it to me, or I'm going to change the government. That's really, again, this is nothing new. This is something that happens periodically through history until somebody starts to grab the hold of the public and say, look, there are other answers here. And the other answers are we let the markets work the way they're supposed to work. We get the monetary system out of the way, and economic growth comes back. It returns. You know, nobody was looking at these redistribution types of systems outside of Europe, for example, in the 1950s and 1960s. Not legitimately, and only in Europe because World War II had devastated everything. People wanted to be reassured with their social safety nets. That, you know, if we have to survive World War II, we better be taking for granted or taken care of. Whereas the rest of the world said, look, the economy's booming. We don't need to get involved into redistribution, as we had in the United States in the 1930s during the Great Depression. So this idea of top-down redistribution, again, it's a natural phenomenon that happens that corresponds and coincides with lack of economic growth and lack of answers for that economic growth. And people are naturally seeking, look, the economy sucks, so maybe the government better take care of me. Otherwise, it's just, I'm going to get my torch and pitchfork. And we're going to go down to the local government and start rewriting things from the ground up.
Okay, so my last question, and then we're going to wrap it up. But Jeff, based on like your best judgment and your understanding of the current system and of Bitcoin, in your mind, what's the chance that Bitcoin is the force that does exactly what you described? Let markets run free and get the the fiat monetary system out of the way.
Yeah, Chris, I don't want to disappoint you too much, but I don't think Bitcoin has the. I don't think it yet. I mean, maybe there's a version of it down the road. I like the idea behind it, but I don't think the current version of Bitcoin solves our problems. I don't think it has the scalability it doesn't have the technological prowess, for lack of a better. I'm not saying it correctly here, but I don't think it can solve the problem. It can't be everything to everybody. So it might be that, you know, we have a layered approach where Bitcoin forms part of the system, where we have various competing currencies that perform different monetary roles at different periods in time or for different functions. And maybe Bitcoin is one of those. I like the idea of Bitcoin. I just don't think the technology allows it to completely to complete its mission.
All right. Well, hey, we'll have you back on the show. We definitely respect your take on everything Bitcoin as well as on everything macro, and love to see, you know, you talk about it more and more. I think it's going to continue to be very relevant in the world economy. So we'll see how it plays out.
I would love to be proven wrong. Let me tell you, that would be fantastic. I would love for any of the digital currencies, but if it's Bitcoin, fine. You know, I would love for them to take a more leading role in showing people that central banks are not the answer, that we can do things without them. In fact, you know, in this country anyway, in the United States, the period of our most robust economic growth coincided where we didn't have a central bank at all. So private money and private economy and things like that. If Bitcoin takes the lead and it shows me that I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, I will be the happiest guy there is.
All right. Well, hey, I hope Bitcoin does it. And we'll have you back on to talk about it, hopefully, as things continue to develop. Jeff, for those who are just listening to you for the first time on this show, where can they find you? Where can they learn more about your fantastic content?
Most of what I do goes up at our blog at Alhambra Partners. It's alhambrapartners.com. I write a lot there. Our podcasts are there, but you can follow us on our YouTube channel. And we do things called under the brand Eurodollar University, which is nothing more than an attempt to educate the public on all of these shadow topics, like the interest rate fallacy and things like that, and to get people to realize that there's more going on in the monetary system than just central bank quantitative easing and why bank reserves are not money printing.
Awesome. Everyone, you need to go check out Jeff's channel, go check out Alhambra Partners. And until then, follow me at CK_Snarks, follow Ansel at Ansel Lindner, and go to Bitcoin Magazine for the latest in everything Bitcoin. We're pumping out every single headline that matters, and we're highlighting the best thinkers as well, including the best in macro like Jeff over here on FedWatch. Peace. A quick reminder that all of the content in this episode is for informational and entertainment purposes only. You should not construe the information as legal, tax, investment, financial, or any other advice. Nothing contained in this presentation constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or offer by BTC Media, the Let's Talk Bitcoin Podcast Network, or any third-party service provider to buy or sell securities or any other financial instruments. Do your own research.